Well, this morning, I want you to go back with me to the Old Testament book of Numbers. If you want to have your Bibles and turn in those Bibles to Numbers chapter 13. I think the concept of crossroads is a powerful one, and I talk about it a lot. I can look back on my life and identify lots of little decisions. Probably you could as well. Each one impacting my life to varying degrees. I can look back. I mean, we know this. Every decision that we make impacts us, changes the future a little bit. So I can look back and I can identify many, many little decisions. But there are a few that set my life in a completely different direction than it would have been. And sometimes we know them. Hey, this is huge. We're coming up to it. I know that this decision that I have in front of me, this is going to impact a lot of things. Sometimes we know it, but for me, a lot of times you don't really know until later and you look back and you realize that, boy, that decision that was made at that time in my life, I mean, that had very, very significant repercussions. It set me off in a direction that if we'd gone a different way, I mean, our life from that point on would have looked very, very different. So I can identify a couple of crossroads, sort of forks in the road. And depending on the decision that I made, Faith and I made together, it sent us in very different places. And you probably can too. The reason why we're talking about this right now, and the reason that we're in Numbers 13, is because it feels like we're at a point in history where we have sort of a historical crossroad. We're going to talk about the Israelites passing through the Red Sea, and they find themselves in Numbers chapter 13 on the other side, and their future is opened out in front of them, and they have to make a decision. Will they venture out into the unknown possibilities of the future in front of them? Or will they slink back into the safety of what they already know? It feels a little bit like this as we gather together this morning. Whether we like it or not, whether we agree with it or not, COVID-19 is life-altering. It's a history-shaping event. For many of us that can remember back on 9/11, it's COVID-19. This season feels like that. In fact, maybe even more so. We'll look back on this later on in life, and we'll remember, you know, what life was like before and the impact and the world shaking that happened because of this season. In fact, in some ways, I was hesitant a little bit to talk about this message. The title is The Other Side of the Sea, and I was a little bit hesitant to talk about it because no one knows really if we're actually through the Red Sea or not. We don't really know if this is the first part of kind of coming at it or what's next. We're uncertain about that. So I want to tell you the story of the crossroads in the life of the people of Israel. And I want to tell you that the center of this story are two critical ideas that are very, very important for each one of us. Two battles that every person fights as you stand at the various crossroads in your life. Battles that some of you are fighting right now, guaranteed. Some listening, some watching. Are facing these kinds of things right now, and here they are. They have to do with two words, familiar words. One is the word trust, and the other is the word obey. And they have to do with two big questions. The questions are, will I trust God, and will I obey God? You probably remember singing a song, Trust and Obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. And we sing that song, and it's sort of a familiar words for us that maybe you have not realized how significant those two words really are. They are foundational to your life and to your Christian life, and they're absolutely foundational to the choices that you make and the crossroads in your life. Trust and obey. Foundational issues: will I trust God? And then, as I do, will I obey Him? So, the nation of Israel, the Israelite people, are on the brink of the promised land. Numbers 13, it's right in front of them. Now, in order to really get this, I think you have to have a sense of where these people have been. So to start this, I want to back us up to Exodus chapter 14. If you would go back there with me, Exodus 14. Now, I just want to make sure that we've got the history of what brings us and what brings the nation of Israel to the Numbers 13 text that we're going to look at this morning. But Exodus 14, in fact, let's actually introduce this in chapter 13 and verse 17. It says this: "And it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war and they return to Egypt." Okay, so if you know anything about the history of Israel, they've got 300 years of slavery in Egypt, and now God has released them from the slavery. Moses, remember, came as the lead. God took him out of the desert, brought them to lead the people out of Israel, and we had the plagues that come along the Egyptians, the Passover that takes place, where the blood of the Passover lamb was placed around the door jams of the Israelites, and the angel of death passed over, but many, many of the firstborn of the Egyptians died that night. And that was sort of the point at which the Pharaoh said, okay, you can go take these Israelites and get them out. And so they are freed. After 300 years of slavery, they're freed and they are able to leave the nation of Israel. And what verse 17 says is that, but God didn't bring them immediately to the promised land because he knew there was going to be some challenges there that they weren't ready for. Chapter 14, verse 10. Pharaoh let them go, but now he has second thoughts and he's chasing them. And verse 10 says, "Now when Pharaoh drew nigh the children of Israel," I mean, God was right, "they lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. And they said unto Moses, because there was no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said unto the people, fear not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he shall show you today. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." In the next verses then, we see God opening up the Red Sea before them, and this incredible miracle. It really was the first thing that's going to help them to know that God's going to provide. In spite of the fears that we're going to have, God's going to make a way. So that all happens in the coming verses. And then I want you to go to verse 31. Okay, this is all helping us get to Numbers chapter 13. Says this: "And Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians. And the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. And then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God. I will prepare him an habitation, my father's God, and I will exalt him." All right, so go back to our main text, Numbers chapter 13. This is the background on which we're going to get this story in the book of Numbers. God said they're not ready for the promised land because they're going to be afraid of the giants and the challenges. So I'm gonna bring them through some things where their belief in me will grow. And that's exactly what happened. The Red Sea is parted in front of them, and the anthem of praise that we just read from these Israelites is that God is great. We can trust him. He's gonna lead us and he's gonna protect us. They sing this song. Numbers 13 actually is about 2 years later. They'd wandered a little bit in the desert. There's a few things that happen in here. But now they're at least have the option. They're to be ready to go into the land that God had promised. And God says, go. Take the land. And they said, well, I'm not quite sure. Maybe we should send some spies. And so remember this story. They sent 12 spies to go into the land. 12 men went to spy in Canaan. 10 were bad, 2 were good, right? Remember that? Okay, that's what happens. They send these 12 spies. They go in the southern part of the land, go up through the northern part, circle around, and then and they come back down. That's verses 1 through 16. We're not going to read all that. That's the listing of the spies that are sent out. But let's pick up in verse 17. And Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said unto them, get up this way southward and go up into the mountain and see the land, what it is, and the people that dwell therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many. And what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds. And what the land is, whether it be fat or lean, whether they be wood therein or not, and be ye of good courage, and bring of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. All right, verse 21 through 24 talks about the covert operation. If you're into spy dramas, I mean, you want to read this. What happens in this little part? Verse 25. They get back. They'd been gone 40 days, and all the people wanted to hear. And so it says they all gathered around. They crowded around, verse 26. And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel and to the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. Verse 27, and they told him and said, we came unto the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it flows with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. And they say, you would not believe what we saw. There was food in abundance. There were grape clusters so big that they had to put it on a pole, hang it between a pole, and have two people carry it. Everything that you'd ever want is flowing in this land. You can almost feel the swelling excitement of the people as they hear about the future in store for them. I mean, they'd been living as exiles for their people for 300 years. The last 2 years, they'd crossed the Red Sea, but they really had been living sort of a gypsy life, traveling through the desert. They'd been eating manna. I mean, you read the stories in between. They'd been eating manna, and it was amazing when God said it, but they were tired of it. You can almost feel the text giving the excitement of the future in front of them, the open door, the opportunities. And then, like a bombshell, one of the most deflating words that ever has been spoken at the beginning of verse 28, it says, nevertheless. Yeah, it's all great, but, verse 28, nevertheless, people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. Interesting, the children of Anak is the Anakim, or the Nephilim, were known, it's an interesting study in the Old Testament, known as giants. Goliath was from Gath, would have been part of the Anakim, almost 10 feet tall. And so they went and they saw these giants. So the people of Anak, verse 28 says, are there. Verse 29, and the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan. I mean, it's all great, but nevertheless, what I want to do this morning is I want to give you four obstacles that stand as giants at the crossroads of our lives. And they dictate whether we're going to go forward into the promised land or whether we're going to slink back into the past. Here's the list, and we're going to see this as the text in the text. Giant number one is the fear of the unknown. That was part of what was driving the fear and the hesitation of the Israelites. They just didn't know what was going to happen. And the point is that it is very frightening to not know what's ahead of us. I'm not by nature an anxious person. I don't tend to worry about things. I usually don't lose sleep about what's going to happen, you know, 6 months down the road. But I do know that the human soul is drawn to certainty. And there is a weariness that comes from uncertainty. In fact, this is a big part of what we are experiencing right now. We're going to talk about this a little bit, but the uncertainty of not knowing what's ahead, not knowing what the future is going to look like. You can handle uncertainty just naturally, humanly, for a period of time. I mean, it's hard on everybody, but when you're uncertain for a longer and longer period of time, the longer that goes on, the more unease that happens. There's just a weariness that comes in. I just would like to know what's next. You guys are feeling that. In fact, this weariness of uncertainty, I think, is part of what is driving a lot of things. We've been, in some ways, worried, concerned about this for some time. You know, some of the unrest in the mainland right now there's a lot of other factors, but part of it is just the weariness of uncertainty puts people on edge. And people respond in different ways when they're on an edge. Some tend towards depression, discouragement. You may feel this way. For sure, you know people that are feeling this way. And some people tend more to outbursts of anger and something that I can control that I might even attack against. All of this is sort of the result of the weariness of uncertainty. Do you know the word discombobulating? I like words. So discombobulating, you know what? I was going to put a definition up here. I forgot about that. Discombobulating means to cause to be in a state of confusion, upset, or disoriented. Something has put you in a state where you don't know up from down. You can't spell your own name, right? That's what discombobulating means. It's kind of a funny word, but really that's what happens in uncertainty. I think that's a little bit of how we feel. One thing we all know for sure now is how fast things can change. And the fact that things can change so quickly puts all of us, not only the fact that we're living in change that's happening rapidly around us, but the fact that we thought things were going okay and then it changed so fast means that in the future there's sort of this low-level anxiety because I don't know how fast, or now I do know how fast things can change. I mean, 10 or 12 weeks ago, I mean, everything was kind of cruising along pretty evenly, and you had this little rumor about some little virus coming out of China, and then, you know, bam, the next thing you know, the NBA season's canceled, and then, you know, the whole world is canceled in a matter of a few days. And how quick we went from, for a lot of people, certain levels of certainty, which brings security, and now everything is uncertain. It's discombobulating. We like to know what's in front of us. Sometimes God doesn't provide that look into the future. He simply says, you're going to have to trust me, and I want to talk about that. Giant obstacle number two is the fear of the known. Giant number one is the fear of the unknown, but giant number two is the fear of the known. And verses 28 and 29 talk about these Anakim, the children of Anak, these giants. And then all the ites, right, that follow in verse 29, the Jebusites and the Hittites and the Canaanites, that just sounds bad. And it was fearful for them. To be honest, I'm not sure what is more frightening, what we don't know or what we do know. A lot of times I've thought, you know, what a blessing it is that we don't know what's in the future. And then there are most likely some things in my future that if I knew what was coming, it would, you know, scare me to death. I mean, there's things in our future that just, I think it's good that maybe we don't know about. And when God says to us, as he does here, this is what I have in store for you, I don't know if God really wanted them to know that or not. There's no sense. God didn't tell them to choose the 12 spies. They did this on their own. It doesn't necessarily condemn the fact that they did, but maybe he just wanted them to say, hey, just go forward. I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to work this out. But no matter what, they know now. They know what the potential is. This is what's in the future. And sometimes when we know what's in front of us, that can be very frightening. Sometimes it can cause us to stop. Man, I can't keep going forward. I'm too afraid of that. So that's fear of the known. Giant number three is fear of the crowd. Two spies said, let's go. I mean, we can trust God. He's brought us this far. Let's do this. And then the 10 said, no way. I mean, that's overwhelming. Did you see those people up there? If for some of us sitting here this morning, part of your obstacles and going all out for God is you just have a fear, a legitimate fear maybe, of what other people are going to think. It might be your family members. What will my family think if I'm kind of all in for God? What will the friends that I've known forever, I mean, they've known me back when I was doing a lot of dumb things, and are they really going to accept this or believe this? Or, you know, what's everybody going to think if I'm really all in for God? Some of you young people, you teens, college students, adults, it's easy to become afraid of what our friends are going to say, our friends at school or other friends that we've known for a long time. And that's a very real fear for you. And it's keeping you from obeying God and keeping you of living, keeping you from living for God. And so we choose to go back into the desert because you're afraid of what our friends might think. That's giant number three. And then giant number four is just a fear of failure. The reason that these Israelites hesitated to follow God's leading is that I think part of it was they were just afraid that they couldn't do it. And I think this really started back in Exodus chapter 14. Those of you who have spent life living in bondage, understand what happened with these Israelites. I mean, their people had spent 300 years in slavery. That was what was familiar. In some ways, I know this sounds so odd, but there is some comfortableness in the familiarity. I hated it. I didn't want anything to do with it. But you know what? There was some security in at least knowing what happens on that path. I know what the future is. I'm not unsure. I've got a pretty good picture of what that is. And this happens a lot with people, I think, similar to what happens with the nation of Israel. One of the greatest obstacles in the path of a Christian's maturing process is that sometimes we're afraid to commit ourselves to giving our lives completely to God because we're afraid that we're going to fail. We'll take a couple of steps on this path to spiritual growth, and then we lose it and we back up, and it's like overwhelming for us. And let me just stop for a minute. I want to encourage some of you. In my life, personally, and in the lives of many people, young believers, new believers that I've had the privilege of walking alongside, there comes a time when we start off on the spiritual journey kind of all gung-ho and all in, and then something happens. And I'm telling you, our enemy is so cunning to try to get us off track. and we fall off. We fail. We're all moving forward, and everything was so great, and we're all in, and then a few months down the road, something happens, and we fail, and we take some steps backward, and failure hurts. And at that point, I mean, this is a huge crossroad in the life of many, many new believers, young Christians. My guess is that everybody has some sort of testimony like this, and some of you are in the middle of this right now. And you're like, you know what? Maybe I can't do this. I started off, everything was great, but man, I blew it. I made some bad choices, or I just have gotten discouraged. I've kind of stopped along the path. And at that point is this crossroad of failure. And sometimes it is easier just to go back to the bondage of my past, even though I hated that the whole time. Even though I knew that that way of life was, there was no fulfillment, no purpose, no direction there, it still was familiar, it still was comfortable. There was some security in the familiarity. And sometimes we go back to the just what's comfortable because we're afraid that maybe I'm just going to keep failing. Can I give you just three quick thoughts in regard to this fear of failure? Number one, in your own strength, you can't succeed. And it's very important to make sure that we get that. There is not one of us here strong enough or good enough to live victoriously on our own. Victorious Christian living is only by the grace of God. So a lot of times what happens is we sort of get this, at this point, we started off good, we failed, now we're at this crossroad, this sense of I'm either going to kind of slink back to the past of what's familiar, or I'm just going to, on my own, I'm going to be more disciplined, or I'm going to try harder. And if I just try harder this next time, then things will be better. And there's some immediate results to that. Sometimes there is a little bit more discipline that we need. And there is a little bit more self-control, self-discipline that happens in the process. But there's a very subtle danger with that is when we start to think that the way that I'm going to succeed in my Christian life is I just got to try harder. I just got to be more disciplined. And maybe that might even work for a time, but it puts this other pressure into our lives that has sort of this long-lasting effect. We get this idea that the Christian life is going to be successful based on how hard I work at this. And down the road, this is so destructive. I can't tell you how many people I've talked with and counseled with that have been Christians for a few years, and they're just discouraged in their Christian life. They're making choices and doing right things, but it's really on the basis just of, I just keep trying harder, and that'll wear you out. This is not how God designed the Christian life to live. In your own strength, you can't succeed. Number two, failure is part of the process. Nobody wants it, and I'm not saying that God is pleased when we fail. I don't mean it in that way. But I'm just telling you that as long as our sinful nature is part of us, and by the way, how long will that be? Well, it's going to be until we meet Jesus. I mean, the Bible says that we have a new nature, but our old sinful nature has not gone away. So we're going to battle that old sinful nature. And that means we're going to have some ups and downs. And hopefully, as we mature and as we grow, our downs are shorter and not as severe. But failure is part of the process, even for the most mature Christian. And then number three, success in the Christian life is always based on God's ability. It's never on yours. Listen, in fact, I'd encourage you to write this down. Trust is totally connected with your theology. Remember, we talked about this over and over, but your theology is your view of God. And if you really believe that God is all-wise and all-powerful and all-sovereign, if you really believe that God is good, we say it like this, that God is too wise to be mistaken and God is too good to be unkind. I mean, these are the foundations of our theology of God. He is too wise to be mistaken. He's too good to be unkind. He is all powerful so that nothing escapes his care
and his control, then based on our theology, what we really believe about God, that says that no matter what's going on in my life, whether I understand it or not, whether I get it or not, I can trust God. And I can step out in faith, no matter what God asks me to do, I can trust him no matter what. We were talking earlier about uncertainty. You know, the reality is that life is uncertain. And if you've built your life on your ability to control your future, to control your health, to control your kids' future, to control your finances, at some point, that platform, or at least part of one of those platforms, is going to fail. Every single one of us. I've said this for a long time, that there is nobody that is so secure that one little phone call can't change your whole life. One little text to anybody in this room during this service, one little text could completely change the future of your life. This is the fragility of life. We all experience this. You're like, Pastor, get a little more happy here. This is kind of heavy. And I guess I'm just identifying what we're all feeling. The reality is that life is uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen this summer. You had vacations planned. Now nobody knows. I mean, you might have some ideas. You might try to be thinking about some things, but nobody knows. You maybe had some financial dreams, some projects you're going to complete. Now you don't know. You may have had your future mapped out in, you know, a number of different ways. And some of it might, I don't know, it might still happen just as you've had it mapped out, but it might not. And unless you've kind of put your head in the sand, the reality is that we're uncertain about it. We don't know. But the truth is that we've actually always lived there. The ebb and flow of life and death, the Bible tells us, is unsure. You might think you know. You might sense some part of control because we want to. We want to feel that. We want the security of knowing what's going to happen tomorrow and what my plans are, that they're going to be able to be fulfilled. And the more I can control that future, the more stable I feel. But the reality is, the Bible said this over and over again, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is a vapor that appears for a little time and it vanishes away. The reality is that each of us, we are now 10 weeks closer to the end of our life than we were the last time we got together, every single one of us. And we don't know when that's going to happen. And here's the point. This is the power of the gospel. This is the story of God. This is the story of hope. This is what the Christian has to offer. This remains, right? We mark it down this way. This one thing remains. When everything else is unsure, whether you realized it before or not, you realize it now, and everybody in our world does. And we're feeling this angst of life that is, man, there's nothing that I control. Really, I'm trying hard, but there's nothing in my control. And that leaves us with some sense of uncertainty and insecurity. But I want to tell you, this always remains. That God is too wise to be mistaken. And he is too good to be unkind. And our theology is like a bedrock in the storms of life. It is standing and it will stand. And we hang on to it and we hold on to it. The problem with fear is that no matter what it is, it's like a giant. And every time we let it in, it stands up and it obstructs our view of God and his power. So we have to keep pushing it away.
We can't see God anymore because our fears become all that we can see. Hey, if you're battling your fears, first of all, welcome to the club. I think everybody is. That's the uncertainty of life right now. What's going to happen today? How are we going to handle this situation? What are we going to do about this? If you wake up in the morning and you don't think you can handle life, there are some people I know that are experiencing that right now. And it may be something that's building for a while. It may be something that's just directly connected with this season. You're waking up and you're like, I cannot handle today. I can't even look at the circumstances of the day in front of me. Listen, it is a matter of theology. It is about trust. It's about your view of God. And I want to encourage you that you got to find out who God is. You have to bow your knees before the awesomeness and the holiness and the majesty and the sovereignty of the Almighty God of this universe. This one thing remains. This bigger view of God. Because when we get a bigger view of God, then we get a smaller view of ourselves, and our problems don't seem so overwhelming after all. You say, well, how do I get a bigger view of God? This is really maybe next steps. I didn't put it in the slides as next steps because I didn't think about it till late this morning. But I think it's a really, really important question. It might be the most important thing we're saying here this morning. You say, boy, I'm tracking with you. So how do I get this bigger view of God? Do I just like hope for it? Do I pray for it? Can I tell you two things? And they're simple. They're not anything novel. But I'd like to tell you how significant they are. If maybe what I'm talking about this morning is hitting home, then these two things are so important for you. Number one, you have to spend time in God's Word. And I'd encourage you to start keeping an attributes of God journal as you spend time in His Word. Starting to write down, this is what I see about God. This is what I see about God. This is what I've learned about God and His nature. To have that foundation of theology, not just some list that you're making, but starting to really know and see who God is so important. And then coupled with number two is this idea, and sometime I'm going to come back to this, is this idea of personal memorials. The Old Testament especially talks a lot about memorials. When God did something for the nation of Israel, He said, I want you to build a memorial that will remind you of what I did with you and for you at that time. What was the purpose of the memorial? So that when your children come back and they've forgotten what you had done in the past, we're able to go to the memorial and we're to say, this is what God did for us. It's not an overnight process. These two things don't happen, and tomorrow, all of a sudden, your view of God is going to be bigger. But I'm telling you, if you'll invest your life in these kinds of things, year by year, you're going to find your trust in the bigness and the awesomeness and the sovereignty of God grow. Faith and I can look back, and I know this shape has shaped my life. But when I come to hard times, I think part of the reason why I don't feel super anxious about it is I really do have some memorials in the past, and I can look back and I'm saying, man, God did that then. He can do it again here. He may or may not choose to, but He's good, and He's awesome, and He's big, and He's sovereign. And I know it because I read it in His Word and because He showed it to me over the course of my life. Memorials. Well, these four obstacles, fear of the unknown, fear of the known, fear of the crowd, fear of failure, they stood like giants in the path of the nation of Israel, blocking their vision and their focus. Real quick, I want you to go back to the text. Verse 29. So the 12 spies finished their report, and they're telling all about the giants, all about the obstacles, and fear begins to grip the people, and it seems like they must have all started talking at once. Verse 30 says that Caleb stilled the people and he goes, you know what? The report is absolutely true. It is a place of phenomenal blessing. The inhabitants are strong. They have great walls and there's a lot of them. There's no question that there are obstacles.
But Caleb said, but God has promised us that land. He has promised us that land, and he's shown himself mighty. We've just come through the Red Sea, and he's protected us from Pharaoh's armies. Let's go. He's going to give us the strength to do the job. We can trust him. The only option that we have is we must obey. We must trust, and then we must obey. The truth was, there wasn't anything that these people could do about their fears. The obstacles were there. They are real. They weren't going away. They could ask God for courage. But the real question was, were they going to obey God in spite of their fears? Or would they slink back and allow their fears to paralyze them? Please, please hear me on this. God is not always going to remove your fears. They're going to be part of life. They're part of our humanness. It's part of the uncertainty of the world that we live in. Sometimes he does. It's okay to ask God for courage, but really what real courage is about, courage doesn't mean an absence of fear. Courage is doing your duty, doing what you're supposed to do in spite of your fear. That's real courage. So the issue is not, God, will you take away my fear so I can do what you want? The issue is whether we'll choose to do what we're supposed to do, whether we'll just choose day by day to obey even in spite of our fears. Can I just read chapter 14 and the first couple of verses say this? And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. They had just crossed the sea. They were on the other side of the sea. God had brought them through it. He had shown his power. And the promised land was right in front of them. They could see it and they could taste it. And they saw the obstacles. And they shirked back, and then they cried. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and the whole congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, back in slavery, or would God we had died in the wilderness? Wherefore hath the Lord brought us unto this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? And they said one to another, let us make a captain and let us return unto Egypt. And I read this and I'm like, come on, guys. And I know that this happened several thousand years ago. I know that, but I can like feel this. I'm like, come on. What are you guys doing? The future's in front of you. Why are you going back? This morning, God has placed some of you here at a crossroad. I think this is powerful stuff here. And some of you are at that place, and you know it. It might be a place of great decision. It might be about whether you're going to move forward in your walk with God or whether you're going to go back to Egypt, go back, you know, to that path. But I promise you this, you can't stay where you are. It just doesn't happen that way. You're not going to stay in the place that you are. You may have been at the crossroad that you're at for a long time, or it might have just been a brief time. Some of you know that God wants your heart. All of it. All of your life. And you've been battling that. And you're at a place of decision, a crossroad. Some of you here are on the verge of making a very bad decision. I don't know what it is. But you can feel that right now. In your heart, you're battling. Whether you're going to move forward with something you know is not right, it's not pleasing to God. It's a crossroad. It's a crossroad, and the decision that you make is going to send you in one direction or another, and it possibly might have very, very significant impact on ultimately where you end up. Some of you are just battling God for obedience in some areas of your spiritual walk. For some reason, you've been holding out. You know God's asking you to do something, some step of obedience, but you've just been fighting against it. Maybe you're afraid of what you have to give up. Maybe you're afraid of what it'll cost you. Maybe you're afraid that God will expect something from you if you give him everything. And you're just like these people of Israel. You're wandering around in the wilderness. Just over the ridge is God's very best for your life. It's a land flowing with milk and honey, but all you can see are the giants. Listen, I don't have any magic formula this morning. You really just have to answer the same questions the Israelites faced. Will I trust God? And the ultimate question is, will I obey God? No matter what he asks, no matter where he sends, no matter what he requires, will I obey God?